Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Happy Memorial Day. I'm Allison Stewart, and this is All of It on WNYC. With summer right around the corner, the team and I thought this would be a great time to bring you a show dedicated to summer reading. First up, a memoir by fashion designer Isaac Mizrahi. You likely know him from his iconic runway shows or his documentary Unzipped, or maybe for his groundbreaking chic Target line, or maybe his turn as a judge on Project Runway All-Stars. But whatever you think you know about Isaac Mizrahi, there is more to know. Isaac's new memoir, titled I Am a Memoir, chronicles the life of this world-renowned designer, from his earliest days constructing puppet shows and skirts for his mom in the basement of their Brooklyn home, to his early years working at Perry Ellis and Calvin Klein, to his later career highlights, getting advice from Liza Minnelli and performing a one-man show. I Am is available in bookstores now, and I talked to Isaac Mizrahi about it recently and began by asking him about his writing process.
It takes years. It took me years to write this book. And also, I was talking about this earlier, you know, the bravery doesn't necessarily come in the writing process, even though I think you do have to be really brave to write anything, like just to write, you know, fill out your tax returns, right? But the bravery really comes in the presentation, like right now, you know, seeing all the interesting comments on social media and seeing reviews and just going out and talking about it, you know, because it's been so insular for the past 7 years, just me and this editor kind of working on the book. And now suddenly people are going, oh, that part about your mother, that part about your first sexual experience. And I'm like, how dare you get so personal? And yet then I remember that I actually wrote this book, you know. Yeah.
When you first started the project, you start projects with one thing in mind, and then over time, life changes and you change. What did you start out wanting to write, and what changed along the way?
That's a great question. I mean, I started out actually wanting to do a picture book, a picture memoir, right? Like a scrapbook. And I had dinner with a friend of mine who was like, no, you know, you should write a memoir. And I was like, oh, you're crazy, right? And then, of course, like that night I couldn't sleep. And for the next week, I couldn't sleep just thinking about this idea. And I was like, you know, that's a really great thought. And when I started writing the book, I didn't think necessarily I was writing a memoir as much as I thought I was writing like a novel about my life or something. Yeah. And so like, you know, this is going to sound kind of mercenary, but like the reason I did it is because I foresee myself, I want to be a writer, you know? And so I thought, well, take a job writing something you know a lot about, you know? Like I don't have to move to Pakistan for 2 years and research jewels found in those mountains or something. I know the whole story. It's the story of my life. So I can write it in depth without doing too much research, you know? And that's, and it was like a writing exercise, right? But then by the end, it was this total like sort of uncovering of stuff about my life and who I am and, you know, like the story of my life and what it means. So that's how it changed. It went from this mercenary thing like, oh yeah, I'll take a job writing because I want to be a writer, you know, to this crazy kind of like tearing away of layers and stuff, yeah.
Were you someone who kept journals?
I did keep journals, yes.
How were they helpful?
They were helpful here and there. I refer to the journals occasionally in the book, but not really as helpful because I was going way, way, way back before I journaled. I mean, I was going back to my childhood, you know? And even for the first like 10 years when I was in business, right? Like when I was dressing Liza Minnelli and Sarah Jessica Parker and Streisand and whatever it was, like I wasn't journaling at that point. So those memories are all kind of in my head, you know?
So your decision to go back, you mean you go all the way back. We start learning about you when you're 3 and 4 years old.
Yes.
And that's the first half of the book. The first half of the book is your life as a young person. Mm-hmm. Why was it important to spend that much time?
You know, it became, as you pointed out earlier, it became important. You know, like, I wasn't exactly sure. One of the reasons I really loved the editor I worked with, a woman called Amy Einhorn, is because she wanted the book about my early life. You know, she kind of knew from reading about me here and there that I went to this yeshiva and I had this repressive background. as an Orthodox Jew, et cetera, and how I managed to sort of like get out of that scene and mm-hmm. into a more friendly and a more sort of appropriate environment for me, right? And so like, she's the one I made the deal with because she's the one that actually said, no, it should be about this, right? But when I started, I really didn't know how much it was going to be about that. And as a matter of fact, there was one draft I did of the book that was told entirely from the perspective of my mother, you know? And it was a whole other book. And
together, I'd read that one too.
I know, and I would too, actually.
She should do an audiobook of it if still have drafts.
Oh, yeah. Well, she can, yeah. Well, I would love that. But I was going to say that, you know, it took a few different forms until it just landed as this kind of like, what's the word, like a sort of a true memoir, you mm-hmm. know, a true memoir, yeah.
My guess is Isaac Mizrahi, the name of his new memoir is I Am a Memoir. We learn a lot about your childhood, including you had quite a few health issues.
Yes, I did.
Spiral meningitis.
That's
when
right.
you were little.
Mm-hmm.
You had to wear braces.
Braces on my legs, yeah.
What impact did that have on you growing up, do you think?
You know, I think it had an enormous impact on me without knowing, you know, without mm-hmm. being able to guess. Like, I am extremely insecure. If you know anything about me, you know that I have, like, every phobia there is from, you know, claustrophobia to insomnia to a lot of things. And, you know, that's how I live. I've been in therapy since I'm in first grade, literally consistently, you know. That's a long time to be in therapy. And so, like, you know, the point is that I'm not exactly sure, but at some point you have to say, well, at 3.5 or 4 years old, if you're, like, ripped out of the house and rushed to the hospital because you have, you know, that has to have play some kind of crazy, you know, part in why you feel constantly so, like, you have separation anxiety and you're always so neurotic and you see the mm-hmm. dark sides of things more than you might if you weren't ripped out of the house at 4 with a spinal, you know what I mean? I do think it set me up for a kind of life, right? Also, the leg braces, also being a fat kid, like, you know, I have to say, like, that whole fat thing, you can bully me for being effeminate, you could bully me for being, you know, like some kind of crazy artist or whatever, but the minute you say something about me being fat, I fall to pieces, you know? I'm not sure, I'm really sensitive about being fat. And I think it's because I always thought, well, if I were better at it, if I could stop eating, I would be better and thinner, you know? So I took responsibility. Whereas, like, you know, you can't really take responsibility for who you are as a sexual persona. You can't, because mm-hmm. that's what you're born with, you know? So maybe that was it, but I'm very, very weirdly sensitive and weirdly phobic, and I think it all goes back to the spinal meningitis thing. I do.
You were also a handful.
Yeah.
There's a couple of stories that made me laugh out loud and then thought, oh my gosh, if this were my son, where you didn't want to go to school, so you stabbed the school bus
with a
tire with a steak knife.
Yes, I did. I know that is a funny story, and it's really the truth. You know, and I wonder how, like, a 7-year-old boy can actually have the physical strength to puncture a school bus tire. Like, that is determination, darling.
That is, okay. You were a determined little, because sometimes
right, exactly.
I'm like,
no
determination
yes, I see.
Is the word that I picked up from this memoir.
Yeah, determination. I mean, and you have to understand, like, I was doing female impersonations when I was 8. You know, I remember seeing Funny Girl and falling madly in love with Streisand, which is a big chapter in the book, this kind of adoration of Streisand, which is the gayest thing you've ever read in your life. But, you know, but there was something about that that led to something else that led to something else that led to something else. So it's building, you know. And you might not know this, but I'm sort of like tending on another path these days, which is a path that's sort of directly back to show business, you know. I'm appearing in different clubs and different music halls, and I'm doing this big tour in the spring, and I'm really excited about that. And I have to say, like, that harkens back to the difficult childhood, you know, like all of those days when I was doing Streisand and Judy Garland when I was 8 and 10 and people making fun of me, mm-hmm. right? I think it sets me up for, like, a great deal of stage fright, but it also sets me up for this kind of, like, knowledge about how to deal with audiences better or something. You know, when you start doing something that young, you learn about, like, when they like you, when they're listening, when they're not listening, you know? So, yeah.
It's also just something you want to do.
That's right.
You're just like, I'm going to do this.
I just want to do it, and I'm going to do it. Exactly.
The book opens with this scene. I know you've been asked about this, and this is just so interesting that you just wanted a Barbie.
I just wanted a Barbie.
Boy yeah. just wants a Barbie.
I know, exactly. And just, I think now it's a weird scene to read because, of course, now a boy wants a Barbie, you give the kid a Barbie. But in 1968 or whatever year I'm portraying there in the book when I was like however old I was, mm-hmm. 4 or 5, you know, you don't exactly give a kid a Barbie. You start thinking like, why does this boy want a Barbie? He should want a baseball bat and a mitt, mm-hmm. you know? And there is that scene with my mother, and I try to write it with exact sensitivity about her being in that position, you know? Like, do you encourage a kid in the 1970s, right, to do female impersonations? I mean, like, do you encourage them now? The answer is yes. But, like, in the 70s, it was just such a different world, do you know? And, like, it's hard to say what you were supposed to do as my mother in the 1970s, and I think she did such a great job.
You know? Seemed like getting this Barbie, and again, you were determined. You started when you wanted, were 5. You didn't get it till you were 6.
Right.
Stay focused. What world did that open up for you?
Barbie. Well, you know, like I talk about this because I didn't just see Barbie as like another pretty face. I really took her very seriously, and I created this whole kind of fictitious world about her. Like, I wasn't just making her clothes. I was actually like sort of narrating this story about her life. And I think if you followed me for those sort of 15 years when I was doing fashion shows, right, like you understood that it wasn't just pretty faces and pretty clothes. It was like, yes, a lot of pretty faces and a lot of pretty clothes, but a whole story about a woman, you know, whatever the heck that means, you know, and the advancement and the progress and just the stories of every part of her life, you know, and that's what I got. I swear that was the obsession with Barbie. And, you know, when I confronted my mother, I was like, do you remember this at the Avenue U toy store? And she was like, I don't remember. And I was like, okay, well, you know, and for a minute I thought, am I dreaming this? You know, am I dreaming this? And I have to say, a lot of writing the book, I did turn to myself and like, I would say like, am I dreaming that I'm standing here with Liza Minnelli and she's wearing underpants and I'm actually putting this dress on her, you know? Even the other day, Allison, like, I was making out a... I know Streisand. I used to know Streisand, like, you know, 20 years ago. I dressed her and we had dinner a few times. We knew each other, right? And I'm writing the book out, you know, I'm making a book out to her, inscribing a book. And I wrote, like, Dear Barbara... Dear Barbara, yeah, mm-hmm. I guess I'll write, because if I write Dear Ms. Streisand, that's weird, right? If I write like to Barbara or to Ms. Streisand, it's weird. I have to write Dear Barbara, you know? And I was like pinching myself, like, am I talking about me writing to Streisand as Dear Barbara, you know? Seriously, just saying.
You write about your mom. Quote, my mother was the most fascinating person on the planet. I hung her on her every word. She's a gifted raconteuse, and simply, she charmed me.
That's right.
What made her so fascinating to you?
Well, I'll tell you exactly what it was, you know. And this is something that, like, my friends when I was a kid used to say to me all the time, which is that she never treated kids like kids. She always treated them like adults. And I always noticed that, you know. Like, I remember when she first started having grandkids, which was 20 years ago, right? And she had her first granddaughter, and she did this thing. This was a long time ago. She said, I had the best idea for, like, you know, for baby Sarah's birthday, right? And I was like, oh, what's that? And she goes, I'm going to take over a small hair salon and just take all her friends on, like, a beauty day. And I was like, excuse me? That is the best idea I ever heard. Like, 7-year-olds, like, sitting and getting their hair and nails done. Like, really? And she treated people like adults, mm-hmm. you know? And she treated me like an adult, you know? And I do think that that kind of intimacy that we had, that friendship that we had, which is probably not what you're supposed to have with your mother, right? You're supposed to have a mother-son relationship. We had a real friendship, but I think that it echoed itself a lot in the relationships I have with women, mm-hmm. you know?
My guess is Isaac Mizrahi. His name, his new memoir is I Am. What is a life lesson that your mom taught you, which you still carry with you today, which proved to be absolutely true, and then one you found out later in life was complete nonsense?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that I learned in my life from my mother and from life in general, just teaching me this lesson, which is optimism. You know, I think life has taught me optimism. Just the other day, she said this thing to me, which was so fabulous, about, like, getting old and losing your hearing and not being able to eat and or walk. And she was like, I recommend it. Because the other side of that is you're not around to see stuff. So mm-hmm. I recommend it. She used those words. And I thought that was inspiring, right? And I realized then and there that I got this kind of like little genetic rub off from her about optimism, but really life itself taught me about optimism, right? And so like, I think that was the best thing that I got from my mom and from life is hang in there, you know, hang in there. Because it's not easy and it's not pretty, but eventually there are some kind of rewards there for everybody, you know? And I will say, this is important for me to say, and I want to say this on your show, is that, you know, I go on about bullies and I go on about like my weight issues and I had like even an eating disorder at some point, but I am very resilient. You know, I come back is the thing. And I am so fortunate for that. And what I worry about, I do worry about like people who aren't resilient, mm-hmm. you know? And I hope this book in some way can like reach through and speak to those people. That's a big point of why I wrote this book, you know? I mean that. So, and then as far as like stuff that life has taught me that are is sort of nonsense.
Yeah, didn't really, you know, sometimes your parents tell you things, you know, because of their era or because of,
yes.
Yes.
And I will say that and I'm going to also say this on your show. It's like, I am not this person who really kind of believes that much in family. You know, like, I believe you make your own family. You choose your, you get to choose your own family. And I understand like blood relatives. And I especially understand when it's a wonderful situation. But like when you don't really see eye to eye with your family, I think it's like okay for you not to kind of like waste too much time trying to make that work, you know? And I notice that that's a popular thing that people say out there, and I'll probably take a lot of guff for this, like out there on like reality shows and scripted, you know, all everything you see on television and movies, it's all about your family. You gotta do that. But I say like, if it works, then yes, it's you gotta do it. But sometimes it doesn't work and it's not meant to be made to work. Like not everything can be made to work. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Do you think that was a result of because you did not have the closest relationship with your dad? It was clearly you and mom.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I loved my father. I'm using air quotes to say love.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. But it wasn't, it was a struggle between us, you know, and also like the whole community that I'm from, it was like this weird religious thing that I didn't, you know, and all the early lessons about being gay and being stoned to death or something, or even just being an artist and creating graven images, you know. So like the whole religion thing, the whole family thing, and my sisters became really religious. And at some point that became rather awkward between us, you know. And I would prefer not to like sort of dwell on the fact that we can't be that close anymore, you know? Mm-hmm. I know for my mother, it's a big consideration. She wishes we could be closer, but I just can't. I can't because I know that their religion just says stuff about the basic person who I am and it does not agree. So it's a little uncomfortable. You know what I mean? And I love them. I do, you know? So I don't want to struggle over that. You know, and when I watch like, I don't know, The Real Housewives of New Jersey or something, and you see all these characters banging on about family, and I go, yeah, it's true, but move on, because sometimes family, you can't, you know?
And there's different definitions of family.
Absolutely. And you know, speaking of different definitions, RuPaul Charles, right? He will go on about choosing your family, and every time he does that, I throw a kiss to the screen, because that's what matters to me.
My guest is Isaac Mizrahi, and we're talking about his book, I Am a Memoir. We'll have more with Isaac after a quick break. This is All of It. Welcome back to a special edition of All of It. The theme of today's show is summer reading. This hour, we're talking about a new book by Isaac Mizrahi called I Am a Memoir. Part two of our conversation picks up with my question to Isaac about how he chose to enroll in Parsons School of Design after having spent his elementary school years at Yeshiva and his high school years at LaGuardia.
You know, I still struggle with that. I still see that as like a real fork that came up in the road. I think it was like the first year at PA, you know, performing arts was absolute culture shock, you know, like coming from this crazy yeshiva, which was so repressive and so narrow, right, to this insanely beautiful environment that was performing arts high school at that time, where everybody was just free to be you and me, honey. Okay. It was everything. And at that point, it was culture shock. And then a year later, I kind of eased into it and I was really comfortable. And then I would say roughly around the third year, I started to think, wait a minute now, like, look at all my classmates. They're all like beautiful, thin. They can be cast really easily in a lead of something. And then there's you, this like fat kid, you know, and like probably not that easily cast, right? And so I started to get scared. And at that point, I thought, you know, I have the secret, which is that, which is not about being gay, which is not going to be well received probably in the house. And I better start, you know, kind of covering my ass here a little bit and think about somehow making money so I could possibly get away from that and live the life I foresee, you know. And I don't know why, but fashion just seemed like a more immediate thing, you know. And I joke about this. I say like, oh, I thought, uh-oh, the treacheries of show business, better think of a less treacherous business to go into, fashion, right? Like hold for laughs, you know. But it's true. Like for some reason at that time, it seemed much more likely that I'd get a job like somewhere in the fashion business. Whereas like I didn't see myself getting cast in, you know,
Oklahoma,
exactly, or even a Chorus Line, you know, or any of those things. I thought better get a plan B here, you know, and I did that, and I was into it, and I think I'm pretty good at it, you know. So it thrived, if I will. It thrived. And then I decided, okay, I'm going to go to Parsons, right? I started sewing. I started making clothes for myself and for my mom. And my friends got to know me in performing arts as this person who liked fashion, you know. And there was a girl in the year before me at PA, and her name was Sundi Leek. I don't know if she was this beautiful girl, and she was a really, I know Sundi Leek, and she was a great designer, and she was a fashion designer. So she was like, she set the tone for me. She's like, another drama person who went straight to fashion, right? And so that's how it happened. I actually started making clothes with this friend of mine, Sarah. And we started selling them when I was a senior in high school. We had this small collection, and it was available in like 3 or 4 stores in New York City. I mean, I was a hustler on top of everything else. Yeah.
That doesn't surprise me. So, you know, you're in the book, you're clearly comfortable with your sexuality. It's not an issue for you. You are who you are. Mm-hmm. And you come out to your mom, mm-hmm. have that conversation. You don't have the conversation with your dad. He passes away.
Yeah.
Had you rehearsed having it with your dad?
No, because as I mentioned earlier, like I was in therapy the whole time, right? And I and the therapist I saw in college, I paid for with my own money. I made money selling sketches and doing puppet shows and doing all this other stuff. I made some money. And I spent the money on therapy because I was so used to having therapy. And it never occurred to my parents that I would. I mean, they were in their own world, too. They had their own problems and stuff when mm-hmm. I was in college. So I sought out this fantastic therapist and I saw him. And for a few years, and they didn't know about this. This was under the wire, right? Still living at home, going to college and seeing this shrink, right, in Greenwich Village. And he told me, like, yeah, probably don't need to tell your father. Like, you would do better not. And I was like, well, okay, well, if you say that, mm-hmm. he endorsed that. My mother came up with this. She said, you know, don't tell your father, right? And then he was like, yeah, your mother is right. Don't tell your father. And I was like, okay, responsibility averted. And I felt so much better about everything, you know?
Did it change? I wonder, because I have friends who, after they've come out, say, you know, it's like the sky opened and I suddenly was able to tap into other creativity,
right.
And I
yeah.
wasn't spending all this energy on trying to deny myself that I had a
yes.
It created opportunity that wasn't expected.
When they came out to their father.
Yeah. Yeah. Or your family or just
or
to somebody
family.
Close.
Well, I came out to my mom and my sisters, and you know, I honestly, like, there's this story about like when my dad passed away, about not saying Kaddish for him, because I just didn't believe it. And I just thought, like, it was a year of my life and I couldn't do it. And it was the best decision I ever made. But, you know, if I was another person, I might have said, oh, God, I really blew it, you know. Mm. I don't feel like it was wrong to keep that information from my dad. I really don't. And in some ways, I feel like we were communicating on like a kind of this underhanded way about it. You know, like maybe he knew, right? And he didn't have a good heart and he was constantly having these heart attacks. And I thought maybe best to just keep it. And you know, and so I go back to this thing about family and like the responsibility to like, you know, I still think it was the right decision not to tell him. I mean, that sounds crazy, but, you know, call me and we'll talk about it. Right? Seriously.
My guest is Isaac Mizrahi, his new memoir, I Am a Memoir. So it's interesting to read about how you started your career. And I'm thinking about young designers now. Mm-hmm. What is something that young designers now have that you think, I wish that had been around when I was starting out?
I think the reverse.
Oh, interesting.
I think the reverse. I wish that young designers had what I had, you know? I wish they didn't have social media, and I wish they didn't, I wish they had more like sort of sample rooms in New York City and more like actual creative, like sort of laboratories and places to get clothes made and places to make their own clothes in New York, because like that's gone, darling. That is literally gone. I think that the garment district is like stripped bare now, you know? And I really wish that those starting out now had these places to go to kind of like, you know, really kind of confer with textiles and with beautiful sewing and with beautiful manufacturing, you know. I mean, even in my day there were so fewer than the generation before me, but now I wonder how people, you know, it's all about manipulating a mouse now, you know, a mouse on a computer, and they draw on computers and they just get these clothes back from parts of the world they don't even know, you know. The samples are all made, and it's like you get one shot at doing a sketch, you know. In my day, it was like we really sat there in rooms and draped together and made clothes together. The other thing I wish they didn't have is this crazy kind of like game show thing that goes on. Like, you have to make this in 24 hours. You know, we made a sleeve in 24 hours, you know? And I always say that about cooking too. It's like, you need to add time to the clock if you're gonna cook something really good. Mm-hmm. Not get someone to make something in 15 minutes, because what can you really make in 15 minutes? Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, there's just too much pressure put on the whole creative process today, so one tends to default to like the least common denominator, you know?
Is there an upside, however, I'm gonna challenge on this, is there an upside on getting rid of the gatekeeper and the middleman? Like, I can make something, I can have my own website, or I can put on Instagram, and there's no person telling me that's not what we need right now. That's not fashion. That's not good style. You just can go ahead and do it yourself.
I'm not sure, because I think like learning to live with that sort of feedback is a really important thing for an artist. You know, I mean, like on a bigger scale, if you want to open up that conversation, I think that criticism is everything, you know, like both like sort of drive by sort of, you know, like you're bad, you know, that's important, to like, here's why you're bad, to like, you're really good, to you're great. All of that stuff kind of works in a designer or an artist's head, and sort of like you churn and churn and churn, and then you do something based on that, you know. And today it's very challenging because of like Yelp reviews or something, you know, like anyone can go, no, this is no good, you know. Whereas, like, if you're talking about, like, a really good art critic, you know, like, you tend to listen to that art critic, right? Seriously.
He's an expert. Someone who's
an expert. And when I read, like, Roberta Smith, I kind of, like, believe what she says, because she loves the subject. And she's been looking at it for a longer time than a lot of people who post, you know? I just mean that. And so, yes, in a way, I guess this opening of the floodgate is a good thing, maybe for like generations after us that don't remember sort of really, really good and important and solid criticism, you know?
Can you remember a piece of criticism you got that really helped you in your
career? I can. Yes, I can. I remember the first, this is a crazy thing, the first time I had a one-person show downtown, at this little theater called the Greenwich House, which is now the Barrow Street Theater. And it ran for a year. I mean, it was like forever, this thing. And I worked on it for years. I wrote it. I worked with this wonderful musical director, Ben, who I still work with. We did the show and, you know, it got a lot of reviews and really good reviews. And there was one review. It was a very short review in The New Yorker, right? And I have a feeling I know who wrote it, which is terrific. And that critic said, like, yeah, it's really good, but if you really want something good, you have to see him on his feet. Like, you should just see him, like, be in a room without a script, you know? That would be the better show. And I was like, well, you know what? That person is absolutely right, because that person, I think, if I'm guessing who wrote that, knows me, you know? And that person knows that I am very, very, very good on my feet. And that actual piece of criticism pushed me to where I am now as a performer. And, like, you know, I sort of rehearse with my band a lot and I rehearse the music a lot, but then the patter has a much broader swath. You know, I just talk about what I want to talk about, right? And when I do these shows, that's the best part of these shows.
My guest is Isaac Mizrahi. We're talking about his memoir, I Am a Memoir. There's an interesting tension between the fashion industry, which can be very exclusive, it can be really exciting and fun, and you want to be a part of the club, and then somebody's telling you can't be part of the club because you're too short, fat, wide, tall, dark,
you got it.
Curly-haired, straight. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of twos. There's a lot of twos. You're two, all this kind of stuff. How did you navigate that, given you know, in the book, you're honest about your insecurities, and, you know, have somebody who has weight issues going into fashion just seems like, let me step on the pitchfork and have it hit me in the face.
You're so right. It was my way of, like, sort of gaining this kind of bird's eye view over people, right? Like, yes, I was fat. And I talk about this, like, it was okay that I kind of early on knew that I wasn't the most gorgeous thing in the room, because it allowed me this kind of, you know, way to step back and, you know, kind of dress in black, which I still do, and kind of stand there and go, no, you know what would be better for you is this or that, you know? And I will tell you this, which is that at some point, that changed, right? And my whole perception of the fashion business changed. You know, when I first started, when I was 18, and I worked at Perry Ellis, and then I worked at Calvin Klein, and I got myself my own line, and then it blew up, and there I was, and I was kind of in this world, and then I went like, oh my God, this world which excludes this person and that person and basically everyone, you know? And the way they sell clothes is just so obscene. It's this thing where people, you know, they convince you that you don't have anything until you have this, right? Like, throw everything away and get this, right? And then they tell you, well, you're too fat for it, your legs are too short, you're the wrong color, you're the wrong gender, whatever it is. You know, it's really, really exclusive, right? At that point, I feel like it's broadened itself a lot. Bless fashion, because it really is, the word fashion is changing its own definition, right? But if you look at the definition of fashion, it's what everybody thinks they want at one moment, you know? But at some point, what I'm getting at here is, like, at some point I looked up and I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And I tried to do the opposite of that. I decided at that moment that I was going to do this thing at Target, you know, and really commit to it, by the way. Speaking of Todd Oldham, we were talking about Todd Oldham. Yeah. I mean, he did a collection for Target before me, but it was a promotional thing. It was like a season, right, or a little tiny collection, right? I literally committed to this for years. I did it for like 7 years. I was like really designing clothes for Target. And, you know, and I think I was sort of democratizing, reaching out and going like, here's what's beautiful, you know? And I remember having like plus size models in the, like, I really tried to push it. I had old people in the ads. I had like all kinds of people in those ads for that time. It was something, you know? And that was my effort. That was my effort to kind of like go, you know, hey, fashion, like, start changing your definition because it's not working, you know?
Professionally, what are you most proud of? When you look back, you got to the end of your book, you see your life, you see everything that you've battled, insomnia, anxiety.
I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to tell you the honest truth.
Oh, please.
The thing that I am most proud of that I have accomplished in my life is that I am on the brink of, like, changing the definition, like really adding the hyphen to the multi-hyphenate and becoming this kind of performer. Like, that is what I'm like. That's why the book ends with this scene at the Carlisle. I don't know if you read the last scene yet. I mean, you just got it. But the point is, like, I, you know, literally shaking under the covers in that room in the Carlisle, right? Going, how will I do this? And then I do it, you know, and it's become really like a big part of my identity. Like, I'm not kidding you. Now people stop me on the street and go like, oh my God, I saw your show in Indianapolis. It was amazing, you know, or I was in at your show in Chicago, and it was fabulous, you know? And that makes my heart, that I'm the most proud of, because as you know, it's really hard to go, you know this, if anybody knows this, it's really hard to go from one thing in your world, one thing, to be known for one thing, and somehow spin yourself into a whole other universe and get to be known in that universe, you know? So I'm not, that is really what my biggest thing is. When people say, oh, I saw you in concert and it was fabulous. Boom.
The name of the memoir is I Am a Memoir. I hope I see you again sooner rather than later.
Me too. Me too.
Isaac, thanks for coming by.
Thank you. That was great.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.